Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. The all-new Opel Mokka. With a new visor front face and pure panel interior, this is Opel.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Today, a national cybersecurity wake-up call. A former deputy director of military intelligence on the lessons the state needs to learn from the HSE hack. With the Indian variant set to dominate COVID cases in the UK this week, we find out more about it and ask, can it spread even when people are vaccinated? Should you buy a car on PCP finance? Owen McGee explains the pros and cons. Embracing change, Dr. Harry Barry on his new book about how resilience can help in changing times. Were you an avid collector of stickers or even Pokemon cards? Find out from the experts today just how much your collection might be worth. Text us this morning, 51551. Email todaycb@rte.ie or on Twitter, we are at Today with Claire. First, investigations are continuing today into the cyber attack that has severely impacted the health service. Gardaí and cybersecurity experts are examining a data dump on the dark web to establish whether it's legitimate or not. The online posts claim to be from the hackers to prove that they have sensitive patient information. I'll speak to Dr. TJ McIntyre, who's an associate professor in UCD, practicing solicitor and chair of Digital Rights Ireland. Also Michael Murphy, former Army Lieutenant Colonel, Deputy Director of Military Intelligence and now Security Consultant. But first I want to talk to Vice President of the IHCA and Consultant Paediatric Radiologist, Dr. Gabriel Colleran. Dr. Colleran, good morning to you.
Good morning, Claire. Thanks for having me on.
Just explain to me what the impact is on you, on your work and on your patients.
So, Claire, the impact of this on patient care can't be overstated. You know, we came into work on Friday morning and we were locked out of our system. So no access to our, in radiology, to the requesting software where clinicians would place requests for ultrasound, CTs, MRIs. No access to any of the electronic records. So for medical consultants who were on call for the weekend, when patients come to the emergency department, any of those electronic records of prior attendances not available to them, being unable to prescribe electronically, which is something that has really been embedded well in the system over COVID and has been really working for patients, accessing medication lists, prior allergies, not available to people. So a much riskier and harder situation and much slower trying to get through what would normally be very streamlined processes. Cancer care in this country is hugely reliable on multidisciplinary team discussions where clinicians, radiologists, pathology, everybody comes together to discuss and make a plan for that specific patient. Those meetings are cancelled this week because we have an inability to review the prior imaging, view the radiology, access reports. So that's directly impacting our ability to provide care. Radiology and laboratory services are extremely compromised with this. So my colleagues, medical scientists and consultants who are working in laboratories, they're transcribing results from analyzers to standalone laptops and then having to try to convey results. This is majorly risky for patients, for example, that need blood transfusions, where you need to be able to access prior results for comparison and to be able to plan what they should get now. In radiology, we have to be able to compare to prior scans. That's a critical part of our work, looking for change, and we are locked out of those systems.
So I'm just wondering how you're managing, because if you don't have this information, the digital record, are you relying on memory if you someone on your team might have seen this patient before, or is there a paper record there?
So for example, taking myself an example, yesterday morning, outpatients that I had booked for my MRI list that arrived, we had no access to the information. Some of them are external referrals. We hadn't met them before. So we were asking the patients directly for as much clinical information as they had, ringing their referring consultant, hoping that they would remember as much as possible. For urgent patients that were referred very recently, people would, you know, normally have a very good recollection. But for patients seen in outpatients a few months ago, and unfortunately because of our waiting list, many patients will have been referred a few months ago, it's harder to recollect. And of course, it's much less accurate than what we normally do, which is check the clinical information we have on the system with the patient in front of us. We have all these safety measures embedded into how we provide care, and they're very dependent on us being able to access them. So at the moment, you know, there's a huge amount of work, Claire, by all of the team going into what can we do to get safe interim processes. For us in radiology, not being able to compare to prior imaging, not being able to send image to the national PACS system, having to try to get local storage in place, local ability to provide reports. You know, people are doing handwritten reports, they're typing them on their own standalone laptops, trying to download, you know, interim software. It's really extremely challenging.
How would you compare this, Gabriel, to the impact of the pandemic on all of you there?
Oh, well, for us in radiology, there really is no comparison. This is so much worse. At least during COVID, we had capacity restrictions, but we could still provide safe care to people. In the current situation, where we don't have access to prior imaging, prior reports, clinical information, and we're relying on verbally contacting people, what patients can share with us, it's just so much riskier. And it's the challenge of it really can't be overstated. You know, we would have children with ventriculoperitoneal shunts in situ, and if they come in with headaches, there's a clear question over, is it obstructed? Is it blocked? And having been able to compare to the prior imaging to see if it's changed, that's a critical portion of work. So this is extremely challenging. This is the most challenging thing that has happened in the health service in the 19 years that I have been working in it.
And do you feel that you can be confident that you're providing safe care in this situation?
I'm confident that we are providing care to the best of our abilities, but those abilities are compromised by the limitations of the lack of access to the normal working conditions.
And have you been given any indication as to when things might be up and running again?
So we know that there's a lot of work going on in the background trying to establish the risks in specific hospitals. It does seem that some hospitals are more compromised than others. Hospitals that have the national system NIMIS integrated into it, you know, it looks like it's going to be longer. But the honest answer, Claire, is that we don't have those answers yet, and there's still an awful lot of work going on trying to get those answers, because obviously if we come back online, we have to be sure that we'll be safe to come back online.
Dr. Gabrielle Colleran, thank you very much indeed for talking to us ahead of another difficult day by the sounds of things. Dr. TJ McIntyre is with us too, as I said, an associate professor in UCD, practicing solicitor, chair of Digital Rights Ireland. Good morning to you. Thank you for joining us on the programme today. There's a big concern here around sensitive patient data. If it has been leaked, and if it has been leaked, can it ever be recovered?
Well, unfortunately, if it has been leaked, you can't really put that genie back in the bottle. So while you might be able to take down particular sites that are hosting the data, the reality is that anybody who wants the data will probably take a copy of it, and it'll circulate then thereafter amongst criminal gangs to the period during which they think they can get some value out of it.
How valuable is that type of personal sensitive data on individuals to the hackers? It's a bargaining chip, is it?
It's primarily a bargaining chip. In a different context, it's an intelligence asset as well, possibly. If you were a nation state, you were collecting this data for intelligence purposes, you wouldn't, of course, be publicising the fact and looking for ransom. You'd be keeping it confidential. You'd be sifting through the data to identify information that you might use to target individuals, for example. In this case, as you say, it's primarily a bargaining chip.
Yeah, I was asking the Minister of State with responsibility for e-government, Oisín Smith, yesterday, whether the government had discussed the potential of facing lawsuits, the HSE facing lawsuits from people, individuals affected by this breach either now or down the line. Do you think that's a possibility?
I think it's a strong possibility, in addition to an investigation by the Data Protection Commission that might result in a significant fine for the HSE. But of course, the question is, to what extent were they at fault? And in some of these situations, it has to be said, with the best will in the world, you cannot fight off a determined, well-funded attack like this. Computer security simply is not at the point where we can do that. We've seen in the United States systems across the most sophisticated government entities repeatedly compromised. And in some cases, those are rather better funded than the HSE has been here. So I don't think it's necessarily the case that the HSE is to blame. But of course, we have to wait for the post-mortem to see exactly how this took place.
We're learning a lot more about cyber attacks and cyber attackers, the gangs who do this. They are notorious, from what we've seen over the last couple of days, to track down, to arrest, to convict.
Yes, absolutely. And the problem here is that many of the most sophisticated attackers are based in jurisdictions which are either actively hostile to Western countries or simply won't extradite to them. North Korea, Russia being prime examples. So that sometimes as well, there's a symbiotic relationship there between the state agencies and the hackers, where the activities of the hackers are tolerated in return for the hackers then being available to carry out operations at the direction of the state against, for example, Ukraine. So I certainly wouldn't be confident that even if you can identify the individuals behind this, that you'll actually be able to secure justice and respect for it.
Okay. Just want to go back to this leaking of information, the dumping of the data that we've heard about. How damaging would that be if it happens on the dark web, where most people going about their daily lives wouldn't know how to access the dark web, how to get that information? Can you just give me your view of how damaging that might be to an individual to have that information out there?
It's the difference between information being available to the neighbour or the local gossip who casually Googles your name and the information being available to somebody with a modicum of technical knowledge who can spend the hour or so it takes to find the dump site and look through it. So it's not all that more reassuring.
Mm-hmm. Patrick is listening to us and he says the publishing of medical data online would be hugely embarrassing, perhaps for many, but it's hardly worth much to anyone, is it? It's not like it's financial data.
Well, as you said earlier on, it's a bargaining chip. There may also, of course, be financial data in there. If the systems have been compromised, you can be sure that some purchasing information is in there also.
Dr. TJ McIntyre, thank you very much for joining us this morning on the programme. Michael Murphy, former Army Lieutenant Colonel, Deputy Director of Military Intelligence, former also and now security consultant. Michael, thank you for being with us this morning. This ransomware attack on the HSE, is it a wake-up call for everyone, including the state?
I would think so. In fact, I know it's probably a difficult thing to say, but we are lucky that this is the type of attack that we've got. That it's okay, there are individuals in hospital that probably may suffer, but we are not part of the national survival attack that could have happened. And because we've had a naive and an incoherent response and thought about security, that this is a chance for us to finally say, this is what can happen if we don't wake up to the threats, the new threats that are out there. In the past, when we had in relation to a defence where you would have had maybe an army would have to invade. Today, that can be done from any part of the world, and they don't. They can take out your dams, where they can open up the dams and destroy cities. In fact, in Florida recently, they tried to poison water in the water system. Your power grid could be taken out, so they could put you back to the medieval times. Mm-hmm. And this is a wake-up call. Now, we had an attack back in back in 2017. The question is, after that, did we sit down and have a lessons learned? What did we learn from that? What are we doing since then? I don't think I've seen anything to say that we've learned anything from that attack. Yeah, hopefully from this one we will.
Except, Michael, we have heard, haven't we, that numerous attempts are made every week to access these sorts of data banks and they're not successful. So surely that tells us that we have some sort of defence there. What's your assessment of that?
OK, there isn't a 100% security. That's not possible. But like such thing, do we have a national penetration team that continuously tests our systems to make sure that they're secure, to see is there coherence between all the different departments, between the different services? It's the bringing together of all of this together in one area to say this is what we need to do. Mm-hmm. But if you have it split in all these different departments and different services, who is responsible?
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because we know we have the National Cyber Security Centre. That's supported by the Garda, the National Cyber Crime Bureau, with the support of the Defence Forces. You're saying that's too disparate.
Well, if you just look at it, you saw my good colleague, Cathal Berry, TD, saying that there isn't even a head of that centre at the moment and that their budget was 5 million. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take, like what you've mentioned earlier on there, the data protection, they have a staff of 120 to 160 with 70 million of a budget. Now, you're talking about data protection as distinct from national security, where in relation to the cybersecurity, where the whole infrastructure could be taken out. At 5 million, it shows that this is the attitude in relation to security. This is a wake-up call for us as a nation to say, this has to be taken serious. Now, remember, there are three kinds of failure. Failure to learn, failure to anticipate, failure to adapt. And we seem to continuously follow those three failures.
So what would you say we need in terms of a cybersecurity unit if what we have is not working properly? That's your assertion.
Well, I would say that we have set up the National Security Analysis Centre, right? Now, we haven't heard from it, except that it's trying to produce a national security policy, which is important, and that would be important document to bring coherence among the departments and services. But there needs to be one person, like a director of national intelligence, a director of national security, a national security advisor, one person who can be held responsible and who can actually have the authority, which is what's more important, responsibility and authority to be able to get things done across all departments and services. And unless we have that, you will have all these little pieces incoherent, all trying to do their best. All of them will be trying to do their best. But unless you have coherence, you're going to reach failure because the weakest point will be found.
From what you know in your work, what kind of groups are interested in attacking us and what parts of the state are they most interested in taking control of?
You have many nations out there which have obviously different viewpoints to the Western Europe. At the moment, we shouldn't have any state that there has an animosity towards us. But all of that can change very fast, depending on some situation in some other part of the world. We can have a minister say something in public about one of some other nation, and maybe the nation itself mightn't want to respond, but maybe what people in that state call themselves patriots might decide to take out part of our infrastructure as a lesson to the state to keep your out of our business, mm-hmm. keep yourself out of our business. So therefore, it's not just states, it's individuals, criminals, private citizens.
So criminal gangs then and hostile states can morph together?
Absolutely. In fact, what is the gap between them? Because you can have criminal gangs, cyber gangs who are working within a state. And so long as you don't attack us, you can do whatever you want. You can make whatever money you may wish. Now, you take like Israel, which has a unit 8200, which is their cyber defense unit. And basically, they've learned that as a small nation, they need to be able to defend themselves. So from the beginning from leaving of school into the induction in the army, they have one of the largest units, and that is the cybersecurity of its state. And the benefit of that, of course, is that when they leave those units, they then go out and they're ready for industry outside. And many of them have set up cybersecurity businesses right around the world.
Okay. So then when bring it back down to how our information is stored when we interact with the state. Uh-huh. Are you concerned about the way in which personal information is collated and held in state agencies?
Well, I tweeted recently on the 21st of April. I had to sign up for the COVID vaccine. And I was absolutely surprised the amount of information that was required before you could actually sign up for that. They looked like, as I said on the tweet, and I sent it off to people, it was a treasure trove for criminals. And unless this is stored separately, if any one group got into all that information, it's detrimental to so many people. Looking for your name, your address, your email address, your telephone number, your mother's maiden name, your PPS number. What else do they need for criminals to get into your bank account? Basically, is what's your favourite colour?
So you're saying we give all of that information. We're just using the vaccination registration mm-hmm. as an example, right? So mm-hmm. you give all of that information over. You're saying that shouldn't be stored together. It should be stored separately or maybe not stored at all.
Or the question is, why was all that amount of information required in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Surely a PSS number should have been enough.
Okay. Michael, actually, just before I let you go, where do you see this going? I mean, we know that all of the attempts are there at the moment to rebuild the system, to see can we fend off further attacks, data dumps and so on. What's your outlook on this entire situation?
Well, I must say, what's happening is a technical problem at the moment. I wouldn't be too familiar with that part of it, but I would expect that at the end of this, that the Taoiseach would form a lessons learned group that people can get together and say, what can we learn from this so that it never happens again and doesn't happen in a worst part, in a more a difficult part for the state, that we get this thing ready for the future.
Security consultant Michael Murphy, thank you for joining us.